Well, tell me about you before we get going to Great Plains. Give me sort of a background about where you're from and how it all began for you.
Well, I'm from Ohio.
Whereabouts?
A town between Cleveland and Akron, northeast Ohio. The town is called Hudson, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not frontier. I mean, it hasn't been frontier for a long time. But when I was a kid, the West and Westerns and Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and things of that nature were things the kids were interested in. And
how about Commodore Perry?
Yeah, well, Commodore Perry, of course.
Put in Bay.
Right. Near my grandmother's house on Lake Erie, there was a grave of a sailor who had died in the Battle of Lake Erie. It's like, what was it, 1813, I think?
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time ago. But anyway, I just... I grew up in Hudson, Ohio, and I went to school there, and then I went to Harvard, and I was on the Harvard Lampoon, and I became a humor writer. I wrote humor pieces, and I did reporting for the New Yorker, Talk of the Town. And then in 1982, I moved out to Montana to do something different, and because it had always been a dream of mine, and I ended up, when I was there, driving thousands and thousands of miles on the Great Plains just because it's fun to drive someplace where there are no other cars. And so after doing that driving quite a bit, I just decided maybe there's a book to write about the Great Plains. So
you went back?
Yeah, I've gone back quite a bit, but I had already driven a lot out there before I decided to do a book. But then after I decided to do a book, I just, every summer I drove. I would take two trips sometimes or three trips where I would go various places. I went from Canada to Texas, really a total of like 3.5 times. One time I was down in Texas and went to Montana and went home from there. But the Great Plains are vertical in the country. That is, they don't go east and west. They go north and south. And I had crossed them many times, but I hadn't seen them until I drove north and south on them. And that showed me what an incredible place they were. And I had seen them just from interstates or looking down from airplanes. And when I saw them close up, I was fascinated with them. So.
Now, just to backtrack a little bit, because I want to go into this a little further. What was the compulsion that took you to Montana to begin with?
It was just something I'd always wanted to do. I wanted to live out in the wilderness, and I lived in Manhattan for 10 years at that point. So, well, not quite 10 years. I lived here in cities for 10 years, and I just decided I wanted to go someplace really remote. And I admired a lot of Montana authors, I was just kind of a Western buff, and I knew about, I'd visited the parks out there, so I just wanted to.
Did you know anybody there?
No, I didn't know one person there.
Now, when you went out to Montana, where did you decide to live, or did you not have a particular destination as you approached Montana?
I wanted to live by Glacier Park, because I had just visited there and I liked it. And it's also, that part of Montana has a just continuous stretch of wilderness that goes from pretty far down into the state and up into Canada. And it's the greatest population of grizzly bears in the lower 48 states. And, you know, it's real wild country. And I just wanted to live someplace very wild and remote.
Was it your intention to live out there and write?
I went out there to, like, write a novel. I thought this would be, you know, a dramatic thing to do, to, like, stop doing reporting for a magazine on a weekly basis and instead just change completely and try and write a novel. And I went insane trying to do that because I was just all by myself out in the woods, and I had never written a novel. And I started writing a novel, and it was really like being in prison, so I stopped writing it And then after, you know, I would just drive around just because that was fun.
Well, it would seem to me there'd be so many distractions. You're there for the first time. So many things to get adjusted to.
Actually, the difference, when I lived here in Manhattan, I found that it was very hard to continue to think about something because you'd have something on your mind and then the phone would ring or somebody would come to town or you would have some obligation. When I moved to Montana, I found it was very difficult to stop thinking about things because there really, I didn't know anybody and there were no distractions. So I would start thinking about what I wanted to write and I would be unable to stop thinking about it. It'd be like 4 a.m. and I just, okay, I'm done for the day. I don't want to think about it anymore.
Did you ever tackle that novel again?
No, I just, some people say they set their novel aside. I quit writing it. And maybe someday I would do something like it. But that particular novel, I stopped.
But it didn't stop you from writing books. You have, your credit, Dating Your Mom. That sounds like a humor.
Yes, that was my first book. It was a humor book.
Tell me about that.
It's a collection of, I think, 26 pieces that appeared in The New Yorker and in The Atlantic Monthly and in The New Republic. And it took 11 years to get that many pieces, so I had enough to have a book.
Mm.
They weren't real. It was, you know, a long time between. Sometimes it'd be 2 pieces a year.
Like a poet, you know, takes a long time for a poet to assemble all of the little pieces that he's written book length.
When the book came out, someone asked me about my career as a humorist, and I said, "This book is 119 pages long."
This is my career.
And it took me 11 years. I don't know whether I can actually say that's a career in any sense of the word career. I mean, it's writing humor is like writing poetry, and you know, one funny sentence, and you feel like, well, I'm done for the day. I've done my job. And so that's what that book is.
It's Are you still writing humor?
I haven't done a piece for a long time. I just got involved in writing longer pieces, and I just kind of continued doing it.
So. Humor is so perishable.
Yes.
It's usually very topical.
It is. I find a lot of the pieces that I wrote in there are very hard for me to read now. I mean, I think people have enthusiasms that change as, you know, as they get older. And I know books that I loved when I was in high school, I can't read now sometimes. And some of my pieces that I wrote 10 years ago, I can't look at.
Even your fellow Ohioan, James Thurber, some of his stuff does not seem to hold up too well today. Some of it does, especially the memoirs and things.
Yeah, I think that I've just been rereading Thurber, and I think it's a lot of it is still really funny. He did a lot of wordplay pieces, particularly he did a children's book that was like that, which I think that kind of thing I find is perishable. But I think the pieces about his home, you know, Columbus and growing up are still pretty great.
Yeah, what was that book called? Thurber Years, Thurber Days, something like that. He wrote a couple of
My Life and Hard Times.
Yeah, My Life and Hard Times.
And
it's so many years since I've read him.
Yeah.
Some of the humor, though, that I recall, I mean, the really out-and-out humor doesn't strike me as holding up as well as his memoirs. Well, your second book, tell me about that.
Nobody Better Than Nobody, which is a title that nobody could remember, including myself. But people just called it Nobody Better. It's a collection of 5 reporting pieces that appeared in The New Yorker. And they're nonfiction. They're on a variety of subjects from... there's a long piece about a fishing tackle shop that was in Manhattan, and that's a piece about fishing and the business of fishing. And there's a piece about... 2 Russian conceptual artists who had come to America, and it's a profile of them. And then there's a profile, I did a profile of Ponce Cruz Evans, who's the woman who writes the Hints from Heloise column. And that was practically my favorite piece I ever did. And the first piece in the book is about a town in western Kansas called Overland, Kansas, where in 1878 there was a massacre. The Cheyenne killed 40 settlers on the prairie. And in 1978, the town had a centennial of this, celebrating this event. It was the biggest event that ever happened around Oberlin, Kansas. And they invited the Cheyenne to attend. And the Cheyenne were going to attend, but then their bus broke down. But anyway, I was out there covering this event, which was a really interesting.
Well, you have some of that in Great Plains, don't you?
Right, and that's where I got the idea to. I mean, that was my first introduction to the Great Plains.
Other portions of the Great Plains also appear in the New Yorker?
The entire text, but not the notes.
But not the notes, right. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the Great Plains. It was of particular interest to me, coming from Wichita, Kansas, where I was born. Is that really on the Great Plains?
It's just off of it, I guess.
Oh, shucks.
I'm about to... Well, it's the edge of the Great Plains is kind of where the real, in a way, the life of it is now. It's like the edge of an ocean or something.
Yeah, well, what is... you're talking about the Great Plains going from Canada down to Texas. Exactly what is or what are the Great Plains? What is it? What is or what are?
Well, the Great Plains are the middle of North America, and they're defined in a number of different ways, but the main way to define it is rainfall, and it's the part of the country that where 20 inches or less of rainfall falls in a year, and that is, when you're driving west, you can actually tell when you have left the Midwestern prairie, which is tall grass, which requires a lot of rain, and when you cross into the Great Plains, which is short grass. And that's when you get on the plains, it's when you get just vistas of short grass prairie, which is buffalo grass and grama grass and plants that require less rainfall. And it's a real dramatic change some places. Other places, it's very gradual. And then the Great Plains, that's their eastern boundary. Their western boundary is the Rocky Mountains. So it's mainly defined in terms of rainfall. But what it was in the history of America, it was the first place that western expansion encountered that was completely different from anything that people had encountered in Europe. So that it required different techniques of farming and different means of adaptation just to live there. And because it was so blank in a certain way, it was a great place for people to project their fantasies of what America was. So that the Great Plains, the Indians of the Great Plains, for example, are the Indians that you more or less think of as the American Indian. When you think of an Indian in a war bonnet mounted with a lance, a buffalo hunting Indian, those are Indians of the Great Plains. And the Sioux and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho and the Comanche, the kind of romantic tribes of American Indians are Plains Indians.
And so many tribes in your book, you show how each tribe, however, has unique differences.
Right. Yeah. It was a place where everything at one time was very specific and divided, and since we've come, everything has been made into, it's been turned into kind of a mass. I mean, differences have been flattened out by our presence there. When before we came, it was an extremely diverse region with very diverse wildlife and of course Indian culture. And what we did was kind of compress everything, compress Indians into reservations, combining many tribes on single reservations, so that differences that had existed between tribes are kind of erased. And
wasn't that always the case, that when the European settlers came, they really didn't distinguish among the various tribes? They thought all Indians were alike, and the Indians themselves had great rivalries.
Right. They. I mean, hunting and gathering, if you've ever fished or picked berries or anything like that, and you see another person in your berry patch, you get mad. And I think hunting and gathering tends to fragment people into small clans, and really sometimes in individual tribes into family groups. And if you see somebody else on your hunting ground, you don't like it. And so they were very diverse and very competitive for resources among themselves.
Now, you describe the Great Plains as flat, and yet at the same time, there are some dramatic bluffs where they ran buffalo off.
Oh, sure, yeah. Before I went out there, I thought it was just as flat as a piece of paper. And I didn't mind that either. I thought, after being in New York, I wouldn't mind just driving on a flat, empty nothingness for 100 miles or 3 weeks. But it isn't flat, and it's really difficult to generalize about it. When white people first saw it, they thought it was the Great American Desert. The reason they thought it was the Great American Desert was they happened to go through the sand hills when they made their first explorations. And they thought, well, this is a desert. And that happened many times in the history of the plains, that what you would see in one area, they would say, well, that's what it's like all over the place. It isn't flat as you might think of it, looking down from an airplane or looking from an interstate highway. It's rolling hills and bluffs, and of course, yeah, places where they chased buffalo off to kill them.
And now you drove up and down and around, I guess thousands of miles along the Great Plains. Did you ever get bored as you drove?
Yes, I get bored to death sometimes.
But you would pull off to little towns.
Yes, there was always something up ahead to think about, and I don't think there's anything wrong with having a place that is in many areas kind of boring, because it's as if we have an idea that every piece of the earth has to explain itself. You know, well, we can save the Rocky Mountains because they're fun and you can ski and they're beautiful. But there are places that are just really nothing there. And it's nice to have a place where there's nothing there. You just go and, well, nothing here. And it can be very relaxing, and I think also the experience of living in America has involved incredible boredom. I mean, when people first came here, really living in Massachusetts in the 17th century, there wasn't a lot to do. And I think there's something healthful about it. I never felt angry when I was bored. It would be kind of a sedate feeling.
What are the towns like as you drove through the Great Plains?
Well, the towns, in many cases, are emptying out. Recently, the drought hasn't helped any, but the way that we have settled the plains has been from an intense settlement with lots and lots of towns to just increasingly larger towns farther and farther apart. And so towns are a highway and some grain elevators and no U-turn signs at either end, and maybe a cafe.
There are no major cities in the Great Plains, are there?
Well, I think maybe the biggest city on the Great Plains, technically, the Great Plains extend all the way into Canada, and I think the biggest city that's on the Great Plains is Edmonton, Alberta, which is maybe 500,000, I'm not sure. Rapid City is a pretty big city, you know, for the Plains. But really, and Denver, I guess, is technically it's east of the Continental Divide, which would put it on the Plains. But it's not, the Great Plains have lost population dramatically in the last 40 years, the last 50 years since the Dust Bowl. And their highest, two-thirds of the counties on the Great Plains have lost population since 1920, which is a trend unmatched almost anywhere else in the United States. They were very densely settled from the 1880s through the 1920s, and this was they were settled by homesteading mainly, and They emptied out after the Dust Bowl, and I went through census records, and a county often would show a drop of 40% or 50% between 1920 and 1980.
So, what is there to attract people to the Great Plains today?
Solitude and and I think still there's a spirit of adventure to go there, but
I bet it's a cheap place for an author to live.
It's a cheap place to live, and it's a great place to travel when you have money to stay in motels. I slept in my van a lot of the time, but they have great motels for like $15 a night, you know. They're really well-kept, nice places, and it is extremely, it's amazing the difference between here in New York. You can live on the plains for weeks for what you'd spend for lunch here. And it's
probably weeks away from a hospital, too, if you need it.
A lot of places have that trouble, and they have one town in Montana that I stopped in. A doctor had showed up that they had paid his way all the way through medical school in return for his promise that he would come and practice in this town. And he got off the, I don't know, he flew and then got off the plane and took a look around and got right back on and left. And it has that effect on people sometimes. They just, it's very disorienting. It actually can make you feel a little bit seasick. It's a spatial disorientation. I described it as when I was hitchhiking there one time and I was in the middle of nowhere standing by the highway, I said I felt like a drop of water on a hot plate. You just feel like you'll evaporate. There's nothing holding you down. But sometimes that can be exhilarating. You can just feel like the only person on earth, and you're inventing it as you go along. And then sometimes you can it can turn around and just feel like the entire world is sitting on you. And in particularly down the southern plains, when it gets hot, it's like you're being, it's as if somebody took a lampshade and you're just in the lampshade with the bulb on. I mean, it's just a different environment.
What are the people like in the Great Plains? Approachable?
They're very friendly, and unlike people in most other parts of the country, they live in a very long time span. They think of things quite a bit longer in the past, and quite a bit, in some ways, they think farther into the future, I think. Because, you know, well, one of the interesting things about doing this book is that when I've talked, I would talk to people, and they would be telling you some story that would involve their family, and the next thing they would be saying, well, now Butch Cassidy came down here. And so these people that you've heard about suddenly enter the story as, oh, yeah, and Butch Cassidy was here. Well, he was actually up the road at Malta, Montana. He robbed the train. And it's, I think, a much greater sense of history. And in a way, it's because the plains are a dry place, like Egypt, in a way, preserves, the dryness makes things last longer. They just don't rot. So there are abandoned houses that are quite old, and you can go in and they're the same house. And in the same sense, there's just not that much turnover of anything. So there, you can be on a ranch where there will be dinosaur bones and arrowheads and and relics from much more recent, so that you can find, oh, I don't know, an example of a recent relic, you know, a Walt Disney Cinderella book or something that you remember from your childhood. I mean, relics collect there, and you can go way back in time in a feeling like there's a house in Medicine Bow, Wyoming. There's a cabin which is made entirely of fossilized dinosaur bones, because there were so many lying around that they made a house out of them. And the dinosaurs, 190 million years ago or something. So it's an exhilarating place.
Almost like suspended in time.
Yes, you can feel yourself way back in time, and you can also imagine forward in time. In the book, I go to a house in Texas, where Bonnie and Clyde one night in 1933 just came in and terrorized the inhabitants. The house is still standing.
Isn't there a marker there?
There's a marker on the highway, but not at the house. And
isn't that strange? Such a small, tiny piece of history that will probably vanish at some point, and there's a marker on the highway.
Well, it's, I looked into
it. It's hardly like a major military campaign.
No, it was, it, but, you know, it says, Bonnie and Clyde one night crashed their car into the Salt Fork of the Red River, and the farmer who lived up the hill came and tried to help them, and they tied him up and shot his daughter-in-law and stole his car, and, or actually they stole a police car when the cops came. But you can walk into this house, it's abandoned, and you can stand there and think, Bonnie and Clyde were in this house. And it's a very, some people have an attraction to ruins and to that kind of fantasy, and I really enjoy that kind of fantasy.
Well, we're almost out of time, but there are a couple of things we really have to cover. You mentioned Bonnie and Clyde, but there are other personalities that are sprinkled all through the Great Plains. And my impression, of course, is that your favorite personality of the Great Plains was Crazy Horse. Is that true?
Yes.
Why did you like Crazy Horse?
Well, he is the Great Plains in a sense that of all the people that you hear about, of all the romantic figures or famous people, he's the only one who was born there and never left. He never went anywhere else. Every Indian of any stature in those days was brought to Washington, brought to New York City, and shown the rest of the world. The Indian commissioners thought it would make Indians easier to deal with if they saw how many millions of white people were going to come and take their land. And he never left, and he fought for a place that he had been born. And so he represents it to me, and he was, after he was killed by the soldiers at Fort Robinson, he was buried, but nobody knows where he was buried. So then in a sense, whenever you're anywhere on the Great Plains, he might be there. There are stories, dozens of stories of, well, this is where Crazy Horse was buried. And after the stories mount up for a while, every place is where Crazy Horse was buried. And you can feel that this tremendously brave and determined and doomed person made this place, gave this place a wonderful quality that no other part of the country has.
In contrast, you have a lot of detail about Lawrence Welk.
Lawrence Welk is another plainsman. I mean, he was made by living on the Great Plains. He was the son of immigrants. He was a first-generation plainsman, and in the latter part of the 19th century, lots and lots of Scandinavian and German and Northern European immigrants came to the plains, and he was the son of this immigration. And he learned his trade. I mean, he became a musician, entertaining these people with his accordion. And he's another person that fascinated me, just because he seemed, it's hard to explain why I was fascinated by Lawrence Welk. I guess he just...
Well, you can still hear his accordion
right,
out there echoing
right.
Along the plains.
Yeah, and he really survived a life that does not always encourage art. His father just told him he would never be anything, and Lawrence Welk persisted and became the most popular musician in American history, according to Life magazine.
So. Now, you go into some detail about the Dust Bowl. Did the Dust Bowl, in effect, sort of spell the end to development in the Great Plains?
To a certain kind of development, yes. It was the end of labor-intensive development. That is, it was the end of the era when thousands and thousands of families would move out and start their own farms. It led to big farming, and it led to, of course, depopulation of the plains. And it was really the end of the Plains as a real romantic place. The Plains then became a setting for fiction. I mean, the Plains next life was as the setting for Gunsmoke and Bat Masterson and Wyatt Earp, and it became and Wild West shows and so forth were the idea of the West as a romantic place was what followed the end of the Plains as a real place to go. I mean, after the Dust Bowl, it was just, the Dust Bowl was a disaster which people out there still don't like to talk about. It was an ecological disaster.
What's happening to the Plains now? You described some strip mining and things like that that seem to be ruining the landscape.
The strip mining was a greater threat during the Arab oil embargo, when it looked as if we were going to have to produce an enormous amount of domestic energy right away, and they prepared to just strip everything. One of the terms that was used was the Great Plains will be a national sacrifice area. Like, we need this power, and this is a place that we can afford to sacrifice. And my contention is that we can't afford to sacrifice it. Today it's hurting. It's a place in pain. I think farms are going out of business, and they've, parts of the Plains have had terrible drought last summer. Parts didn't. The Plains are big enough that it wasn't all a drought, but the drought wasn't everywhere. But it's always been a hard place to live, and it's the history since we've kept records of it has shown that droughts just occur out there. They've occurred every 20 years. People who study tree ring records, that is, reading tree rings going way back into the past, you know, every 20 years, the ring, as you count, the ring is small and withered, which shows that there was a drought. And in the very distant past of the plains, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, there was a period where the plains were a desert. So that it's a place that changes. It's not, you think of it as a certain way, and then it's different. It's very windy, and a field that you think is a field can just get up and blow away, and it's not there anymore.
Ian Fraser, to wrap things up, just to ask you a question about your research. You did an enormous amount of research, a lot of history of the Great Plains. You must have stopped at every historical marker and every library on the Great Plains, huh? And out,
yes,
of the Great Plains.
Yes, I did. I was almost in so many traffic accidents pulling over when I would see a marker on the side of the road, and out there markers are plentiful. And then I came back here and I read books about the Plains in the New York Public Library for 2 years. And a lot of the books were original editions of the, you know, books that no one had read for 100 years. So it was a combination of driving a long, long way, and then reading a lot.
Where are you living now?
I live in Brooklyn.
You left Montana for good?
No. I would love to have a house there, but I ended up coming back here, and I may move out there again someday, but I would certainly love to.
You're still going to go out and visit, aren't you?
Well, yes. The great Western author Marie Sandoz had a house in New York and a house in, I'm not sure where it was, in Nebraska, in Western Nebraska. I think it was in Chadron. And that seems pretty ideal to me.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Great Plains by Ian Fraser. Terrific book. Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you.